ladies and gentlemen. Our next section is on Azure Automation in Action. Let's welcome Marcel Zenner, Cloud and Data Center MVP and Head of Cloud and Data Center Management at ITNEX GmbH, a system integrator in Switzerland.
Thank you. Thank you. Can you hear that? Good? Okay. Yeah, so first of all, thank you for staying here until the very last session before the cocktail party starts. So it's really a pleasure to have you. And during the next 50 minutes, I will talk a little bit about Azure Automation, what it actually is, and what it needs to be successful when you use Azure Automation. What I will cover are these bullets here. So Azure Automation is based on so-called PowerShell workflows. So is anyone not PowerShell experienced in here? Perfect, no one. Okay. So I will tell you afterwards what PowerShell exactly does with workflows. So, but it's very important to understand what workflows are, how they work, how they function to be successful in writing Azure Automation runbooks. Then we'll talk a little bit about the Azure Automation architecture so that you know what happens behind the scenes a little bit when you're running Azure Automation, using Azure Automation. And then we'll talk about runbooks, so how to create runbooks, trigger runbooks, and effectively do automation. And this is something between a level 200 and 250 session, so a little bit technical, but also a little bit overview. What I will not cover, we'll not have the time to go deeply into PowerShell. We'll see some things, of course, but not everything. And also, I will not cover any other Azure-specific stuff that's around, so only Azure Automation. That's very important. By the way, the timer is not running here, just in case, which means I have much more time now. That's good. So, when talking about Microsoft Automation, these are the solutions that are available or are around today. So the oldest solution is Orchestrator, which you might know already. We have seen it in Simon's presentation. Orchestrator allows you to automate IT processes by using kind of a nice and fancy graphical tool, so-called Runbook Designer, where you can just drag and drop activities, link them together, build some logic into the runbook. And Orchestrator is based on so-called integration packs that give you activities that just do something and have some logic built in. What you can expect is that Microsoft will not invest that much in Orchestrator in the future. So it will stay as it is for now. And the new Orchestrator is actually something called Service Manager Automation now, or SMA, which is delivered with the Orchestrator source. And the front end actually comes with the Windows Azure pack. And you also heard plenty of times during these days. The main difference here is that SMA is built on PowerShell workflow. So for now, you don't have this fancy graphical user interface to build your runbooks, but it's all PowerShell code, which could be a little bit scary at the beginning, but once you see the advantage, it's really fun and pretty cool stuff. And Azure Automation is actually more or less the same as SMA is, but it's running in Azure. So it's something like Automation as a Service or SMA as a Service in Azure. So what that means, when we consume Azure resources, we don't have to care about the infrastructure. So we don't have to build anything, but we can just log in, create an Azure account, and start building our automation runbooks in Azure. And for that, we have a browser-based interface that allows us to create our runbooks. And they are then executed using a high available infrastructure. So that means our runbooks that we created are actually living in a database, which is high available, of course. And the runbooks that we start and trigger are executed by multiple runbook workers. So if one worker crashes, another one will take and pick up the job. And we just don't have to do anything. And even if this thing is running in Azure, we have the option to connect to any system that's available. The only thing we need is some option or a way where where we can connect to these systems wherever they are living, even if it's on premise and we can somehow connect to them, or if they're living anywhere in the internet or somewhere. Doesn't really matter. Good, so quick overview what PowerShell workflow is. The cool thing is PowerShell workflow, from a look and feel perspective, it's more or less the same as PowerShell. It looks the same. If you ever created a PowerShell function, you will see that it's more or less the same, in the front end at least. The back end is completely different, because what happens when you execute a workflow, this thing that we created, I call it the thing, is actually compiled into an assembly and is then executed as a workflow by the workflow foundation. So this is just a structure that you might know if you're developing WWF workflows, maybe in Visual Studio or something. That's look and feel. This is not how PowerShell workflow will look in the front end. Not yet. Now, even if it looks and behaves more or less the same in the front end, it's actually quite different. And you have to know some things before you start creating your PowerShell workflows. Otherwise, you might fail. So one thing we know from PowerShell are so-called commandlets. And these commandlets, these are those verb noun things like get-service or something. They have some logic, parameters and things, and they do something for us. So they execute. And with PowerShell workflows, we don't have these commandlets anymore, because we have to use Windows Workflow Foundation activities. Now what happened is that most of the PowerShell commandlets that we know, they are also available as equivalent activities for PowerShell workflows, but not all of them. So there are commandlets that cannot be used directly in PowerShell workflows. And if that's the case, you can still use them by using a so-called inline script activity. That's an activity itself, which allows us to run real PowerShell scripts. We'll see that afterwards. So that's one big difference. The second is when you run a PowerShell script, a regular script, this is normally executed in sequence. And PowerShell workflow allows you to execute tasks also in parallel if you want, which can be useful in some scenarios, of course. But you also have the sequence keyword that allows you to somehow combine parallel and sequential activities to be executed. Again, we'll see that in a while. When using variables, this is more or less the same as with PowerShell scripts, but if we're using those special keywords like parallel or sequence, which we call a so-called lower scope of the PowerShell workflow, we can pass those variables and the values, of course, to those lower scopes. But when you're using an inline script activity for executing PowerShell script code, we need to use a specific keyword again, which is called $using. And with that, we have the option to pass a variable value from the workflow to this inline script activity. Now, one thing that's a little bit risky with scripts or runbooks in general is when you have long-running runbooks. For instance, we have customers that we worked with that had runbooks at that time in Orchestrator that were running for more than 5 days until they completed. So very complex runbooks, and you can imagine that there could be several reasons that could make this runbook to fail, like network outages, someone, I don't know, shuts down a server or something. And what happens then? I mean, depending on the runbook, you have some kind of inconsistent states, like some things have been done, some things have not been done, and you need to somehow be able to either roll back the tasks that were successfully done already, or you have to make sure that you can somehow restart the runbook, but not do the things that have already been done. And this is pretty easy with a PowerShell workflow, because it can persist state. That means we can use checkpoints in the PowerShell workflow that is then stored somewhere, and if we somehow have a shutdown of a system or a network outage, we can just resume the workflow at exactly that stage. Depending on where you execute the workflow, this is saved a little bit differently. So if you use classical PowerShell workflow, started from a PowerShell interpreter, this is saved to disk. If you use Azure Automation or SMA, this information is saved to the SMA or Azure Automation database. And one more thing is that you can suspend workflows if needed. So everywhere in the workflow, you can say, okay, I want to suspend the workflow here. Maybe if I have to wait for some other process to finish and then resume the workflow at a later time. So that's also possible with workflows. And I will quickly show you how this works. So first of all, a regular commandlet that you know, just type in something like that, get-service, I started, and that's a regular commandlet that we know for years now. Now, what we can do is we can write functions, and every function needs to have a name, like test dash get services, oops, curly braces, and in here is my function. Well, I'll just use the exact same thing. If I start this function, what happens? Nothing, because I only defined the function. If I want to use it, I have to start it by just typing the function name, like test get all services. And if I now start the function here, it will execute. It will, of course, do exactly the same because it does nothing more but just getting out the services. Does that make sense so far? Good. Now, the cool thing with functions is I can, of course, pass parameters. So I'll just copy this. Paste it here. And in my function, I now define a parameter section with something like this. Means if I start a function, I can pass a parameter called service name with some value. And in here, I then only want to get the services back that have a specific name. So something like this, service name, asterisk. So every service should be brought back that has this parameter value here in its name. And if I trigger this function now, I have this parameter available here. And I just say like something like win. Trigger the function like that, and it now only brings back those. And of course, I can now use different parameter values. So that works. Now, when we talk about workflows, a workflow looks more or less like a function. So I can just copy that thing here. And instead of using the function keyword, I just use the workflow keyword. And that's my workflow. Cool thing. Let's try this. Set the workflow. Trigger the workflow. Here we go. But this time, this is really a workflow and not a function anymore. And the same, of course, is true for parameters. So same thing here, param $service name. Service name asterisk, something like that. Okay, define it and call it. Here we go, same thing. So it looks exactly like a function, but behind the scenes, it's a little bit different. And you can see that if I take my my workflow that's defined here with the get command, commandlet, let's say test get services, format list everything, you can see that this created quite some code. And at the very top, we can see the XAML definition in here, which actually holds the logic of the activities that will be executed within that workflow. Right now, it's only one activity, so it's pretty simple. And if I do the same thing for a function, so I go up here, copy the function again. Took the same name, so exact same thing. You will see that this looks completely different. This just triggers a commandlet, period. So that's one of the main differences in the back end. In the front end, it looks more or less the same. But we heard that there are some limitations that you have to be aware of when creating workflows. And I will show you those as well. There are commandlets that have no equivalent activity. So like, for instance, this here, which is called get alias. It shows you all the alias definitions for commandlets. And when I want to define this workflow, it will give me an error here. Should? No, it doesn't. Yeah. Saying get alias, there's no activity. So this was not packaged as a workflow activity. So you cannot use this commandlet or this activity in a workflow. But as we learned before, we can still use old commandlets in PowerShell workflows by using a special activity called the inline script activity. That means I can just define an inline script here. Again, curly braces. I just put this get alias in here. That said, this should work now. It does. And when I trigger this thing, this should work. Yeah, here we go. So that said, when you have PowerShell scripts today and you want to switch to PowerShell workflows, you could indeed just reuse your scripts that you have today and just put them in an inline script activity and they will work. But within that inline script activity, you lose some of the PowerShell advantages, like checkpoints. You cannot use them within an inline script activity. That's not possible. So you should definitely switch away from scripts to workflows, use the activities that are delivered, and only use inline script activity where specifically needed. Good. What we also heard is that in PowerShell workflow, we can have parallel activities. And I'll show you that as well. Test parallel, something like that. I'll just give some output, test one, test two, test three. Now, if I start this workflow, these three commands will be executed in sequence. And then now there's a parallel keyword that I can use. Just put all those in there. And now they are executed in parallel. Let's see if that works. Oops, parallel. That should work. Now, of course, with this example, typo here. Parallel, of course. Now, with this example, there's not really a benefit, of course, of executing in parallel, but it's just an example to show you how this would work. So, for instance, if you, let's say, do some some tasks that take quite a bit of time, you could save a lot of time when you can execute that in parallel, if the process allows it, of course. And if needed, you can also do this. So something like a parallel sequential mix, where I can say, okay, first, in parallel, execute those three activities, then start a sequence, which will do test 4 and test 5 something. Oops. Some alignment here. And then after that, go for 6 and 7. Test 7. Test 7. Here we go. Very important, before you execute the workflow again, if you made changes, you of course have to define the workflow from scratch. So here, and now execute it. Didn't happen, of course. Didn't change the name, so I executed the old workflow. Now let's see if that works. And still, you cannot see a big difference here. The only thing is that, yeah, it somehow added test 5 to the very end. But you can imagine that if I add a start sleep here, for instance, start sleep of 2, and execute again, you will see the difference immediately. So we have 1, 2, 3, 6, and 7 in parallel, and then 4 and 5 are also executed in parallel, but it's a sequence with a start sleep at the beginning, so that's why comes at the very end now. So with that, you have very good control over the workflow, what should execute it at what time. Good. One more thing I want to show. I will open, it's already open here, this demo, or this workflow. I call the workflow test checkpoint. And what this thing does is it actually gets all the items of type directory from ctemp. So that's an example to show the checkpoint function of workflows. So in ctemp, I created a folder, sqapac. And this actually reads out this folder. Just execute that. You can see it just gets this folder, which is good. I store it in this variable. And after that, I create a checkpoint, which is then written to disk, to my profile. So it creates a checkpoint. And after that, I just suspend the workflow. So I stop the workflow until I will manually resume it. And once it is resumed, the next step would be concatenate the folder name together with the actual date value, and then output this to a file called result. TXT, also in the temp. So define the workflow. And just to make sure I have no other jobs, I just kill all the other jobs here. And now I start my workflow, which is called test checkpoint. And just to make sure, if you have checkpoints within your workflow, you execute a workflow, it could make sense, or it could help if you assign a job name to your job, because in the back end, it will create a PowerShell job. And just to make sure that you can identify it easily, I just give it that name called SU. So I started. We'll now read out the folder, create the checkpoint, and suspend the workflow. And you can see here, I just type get job again, that I now have one job, ID 18, name SCU, and it's in state suspended. So that means that this should not have happened yet. I will quickly check. So there is no result TXT file here now. I could now reboot the system. That would take a little bit too long, so I'll just stop this and restart PowerShell ISE. We'll get in my workflow again. Here we go. Same thing. And if I just check if $folders has a value, $folder, sorry, I see it's empty, of course, because I terminated the session, the variable is gone. And I will also, just to prove it, delete this folder now so that there's no more folder in there. Now, when I resume this workflow, which is still there, hopefully, it is. When I resume this workflow, it should start from the last checkpoint. So that means step one here will not be done again, the file would not be there anymore because I deleted it, the directory. And it should now continue exactly here. So let's see if that works. Resume job. It's now running. Again, get job. It's now completed, and if I check, I have a result file. And I have that information that was stored in the variable before I created the checkpoint. So that should prove that this seems to work definitely. So just some examples how you can start with PowerShell workflows in your regular PowerShell environment without using Azure Automation or SMA at all. Good. Now, once you're familiar with PowerShell workflows, you can start digging a little bit into Azure Automation and use your workflows there. Now, when you start with Azure Automation, it's important to know a little bit about the architecture. And it all starts with a Microsoft Azure account. So when you first time log into Azure, you create a new Azure account. And within that Azure account, you can create one or multiple subscriptions if needed. And for every subscription, you can configure co-administrators if you want. So that's a level of delegation there. And once you have your subscription, you can start creating so-called Azure Automation accounts. You need at least one. Then you can start automating, but you can have more of them. I'll tell you later why this could make sense. So that's the main architecture. And if you take a look at one of these Azure Automation accounts now, inside an Azure Automation account, you have runbooks. So all the runbooks that you created live in your Azure Automation account. And these runbooks could also rely or use assets. Asset means I want to have runbooks that have no hard-coded information in them so that I can reuse the same runbooks for multiple tasks. And that means that I don't, for instance, don't want to have server names or IP addresses or things like that within the runbooks, but I want to store them somewhere else, like in a variable when talking about the function. And this is done by using assets. So that means, for instance, if I want to talk to a SQL server with a runbook, I don't define the name of the SQL server within my runbook, but I store the name in an asset, call it something like MySQL server name, and I can just access this asset and the value in that asset and use it in my runbook. With that, I can make sure that I have reusable runbooks. And when I trigger runbooks, this will create runbook jobs. They also live in my account. And these jobs are then executed by so-called runbook workers. And these runbook workers live outside of my Azure Automation account, which means I have no control over the runbook workers. I just use them as a service. And that's a little bit of a difference compared to SMA, because when you have an on-premise SMA infrastructure, you, of course, also control the runbook workers. So that's a big difference here. So that means I cannot install anything on the runbook worker. Just not possible. Good. Now, what's important here to know is right now, the delegation of control or of access is done at subscription level only. So even if I have more than one automation account, I cannot somehow delegate permissions to some of my admins to only specific accounts. Or if you go a level deeper, to specific assets. That's not possible now. That might be changed someday. If you're working with Orchestrator, this works in Orchestrator today. It doesn't in SMA and in Azure Automation yet. So you have no role-based access. But it could still make sense to create more than one Azure Automation account. You can actually create up to 30, which, I don't know, could make sense probably, depending on the scenario. One reason to create more than one Azure Automation account could be, first, if you want to somehow separate your development environment from your production environment, so you have that separation there, not from a access perspective, but from a runbook and assets perspective. Or you could create Azure Automation accounts in different regions. So depending where your Azure workloads are living, in South Asia or in Western Europe or in the US, whatever, it makes sense to have automation accounts that live in the same region, just to make sure that you have good performance. And one more thing is the so-called fair use policy, which just lives on Azure Automation in the backend somewhere, that makes sure that long-running runbooks do not dominate the runbook workers. So that means when you have a runbook that runs more than 30 minutes, it will suspend after 30 minutes to make sure that the other runbooks that are in queue can be executed. And once the others are executed, our runbook will be resumed. So it could make sense to move long-running runbooks to separate automation accounts. Good, and that said, we're now ready to create runbooks. And runbooks are created in the browser. So it's a browser interface with all its good and negative points, of course. We have kind of color coding in there. We have a little bit of IntelliSense, but very simple. We have an option to have, or we have, two versions of each runbook. So one is the checked-in runbook, so the production one. And we can check out that runbook and edit it. It's the so-called draft version. We can edit the draft version while the published version is still in production running. And when we make changes, we can also directly test the runbooks in the browser. So just to see if our changes work as expected. And if they do, we just recheck the runbooks in so that the old published version is now overwritten by our new version that we just created. When you already have PowerShell workflows, for instance, in your dev environment, and you want to bring them to your production environment, you have an option to import runbooks. And you can actually import your own runbooks that you created somewhere, or you can import runbooks from the so-called library, or the gallery. That means the community or Microsoft or whoever can publish runbooks there that you can reuse. But of course, if you do so, just make sure that this runbook does exactly what you want it to do. Maybe test it in a test environment first. And also, of course, before you test it, check the code. Good, now lately this was a little bit extended. And if you import not a runbook, which is a workflow, but you import a script, the script will automatically be converted to a runbook. So remember, we need the workflow keyword. We have some limitations, like, for instance, commandlets that have no equivalent activity. And this information will be automatically transported into an inline script activity if it exists. Also, positional parameters are not allowed in workflows. So that means I always have to define the parameter name, dash name value. I cannot just submit the value. It's not possible. And if that is true in a script that you import, this will also be changed automatically for you. But still, of course, you need to check afterwards if the workflow or the runbook looks like as it should and maybe do some minor modifications there. Now, these are some examples of assets. global assets that are living in the automation account that you can use in all the runbooks also living in the same automation account. So for instance, you can store, you can see simple variable values. So like here, I don't know, Azure Automation Logging Database is a variable which just holds a server name. And I can then access this value from any runbook. And if this server name changes in the future, I just have to change the asset value and don't have to touch my runbooks. What I also have is credentials. So depending on the runbooks, I need to log in somewhere. And for that, I can just store credential assets in my global assets and again, connect to those and reuse those in the runbooks without every time entering the credentials again. And that's a little bit of a problem now because we cannot, let's say, we cannot restrict access to credentials. So if someone has access to your automation account or to your subscription, he can access all the credentials that live in that automation account. Could be a problem. But that will change someday. We also have, for instance, schedules. If you have runbooks that should automatically run based on a schedule, like every hour or every week or something, you also define them in here, and then you can just bind them to one of your runbooks. So this is very important. This is also important. So when you have multiple runbooks, you have the option to nest runbooks. That means one runbook can call another runbook. And this is actually a strategy that you should use when creating runbooks in Azure Automation or everywhere else, so also in Orchestrator or in SMA. You should create runbooks that have a single function and not the super complex runbooks that do 10 things at a time. This is also good, but the problem is you cannot reuse those. So you should have really specific runbook with one single function and then combine all of these functions that you need in a so-called parent runbook. We, in our company, we call that concept the so-called solution and pattern model. That means we create pattern runbooks that have one single function and then we combine those as needed in a solution runbook. Good, and you can of course trigger runbooks as needed from any other runbook. Oops, wrong way. Then to get a little bit of transparency of what's happening in the backend, you have the dashboard where you can see all the jobs that were executed. So you can immediately see, okay, yesterday I had 20 runbooks that were running. I can see the job status down here just to see, do I have an issue with one of my runbooks? Do they run as expected, whatever. This gives some transparency, not super deep transparency. I'll show you a solution afterwards. This is what you get out of box. Now, when you have your runbooks living in Azure, you might also want to start them from outside Azure. And you can do that by using the Azure PowerShell module that you might know. You can download it and just start it from your computer or somewhere. And the only thing you have to do is you have to connect to your Azure subscription. And once you're connected and authenticated, you can just start every runbook that's available in there with this start-automation, Azure Automation runbook commandlet. And just define what runbook and where it lives, so in what automation account. And then it gets started. Let's see how this looks like. So this is Azure. On the left-hand side here, I have the automation space, and in there I can see all my automation accounts. I have two for now. I can easily create a new one by just hitting create, SCU. I can select the region. It's also given. Western Europe, whatever. Hit OK. Takes some seconds, and I can start creating runbooks in there. But for now, we'll select one of my existings, which is this. And in here, I get the dashboard that shows me the history of my job executions. Here we go. I need some more seconds to load the jobs down here. We'll skip that for now, just to make sure we don't lose that much time. And I could also filter here. So if I don't want to see all the jobs, but only running jobs or only failed jobs or whatever, I could just tick those boxes there. Then I have the runbooks. And in here, you also have the option to filter if you only want to see specific runbooks with a specific state. Right now, it shows all the runbooks. And what's important here is that you can also see this, the job status of the latest jobs. But these runbooks also have tags, and these tags can be used to easily search runbooks in this view, because you can imagine if you have 500 runbooks, it's pretty hard in that view to navigate to your specific runbook. So if I just click here and say, okay, I want to see something like that, log, we'll just filter based on the runbook name and based on the tags and just show me those runbooks so I can easily find them. Before we deep dive into a runbook, let's quickly check the assets. This is pretty simple but very important and powerful. So in here, for instance, we can see I have a variable for my subscription name, and if I go in there, I can just see the value, which is sub one. That's the name of my subscription. And it seems that I'm using this this asset in one or more runbooks. Or you can see here from the type, I have a credentials thing. For instance, for my domain that's running on Azure. And I can see the username, and I can see the password, which is there in encrypted form. And again, if I connect to one of my VMs running in Azure, I can use these credentials. Or the schedules, just to show you that. Daily 7 a.m. with the configuration in here. Yeah, which is configured with another time, but it doesn't matter. Good, now let's take a look at the runbook. And I have a very simple demo runbook here, which is called Concatenate Names. If I go in here, I again have a dashboard, but this only shows information about this specific runbook compared to the dashboard before, which shows information about all the runbooks. And again, down here, I can see the jobs that were executed. This looks pretty successful. If I go to author, I can now see my two versions, so the published version. And in here, you can now see the actual workflow. So same thing, keyword, then I give the runbook a name, and then I have the workflow definition in here. And as you can see, this runbook takes two parameters, the first name and the last name, and it does nothing else but concatenate those two values together and creates an output with that new value. That's it, so pretty easy. If I want to change the runbook, I just go to the draft mode, edit, creates a new version. So that means even now, if I'm editing this runbook, if it gets triggered by some other process, it will still be triggered and use the published version. Okay? And you can see the difference here is in the draft mode, I have kind of a nice color coding where I can see a little bit better what's going on. I could now test the runbook, or I can just publish it, which gives a new published version, and then start it. Do that right now. Let's start it, because I defined two parameters. I have to define the values, first name, last name, and I just started. What happens now is this creates a record in the Azure Automation Database that then gets picked up by one of the runbook workers. This runbook worker will compile the workflow and then execute it. And this can take a while. We should be able to follow it here in the jobs. So you can see now it's starting, and we'll come back to that afterwards. I would say this takes up to a minute until it's executed completely. Meanwhile, we can have a look how you can start it from outside Azure. So I'm now on my local desktop here, and I already prepared that because I'm lazy. Where is it? Here we go. So the thing you have to do is you first need to connect to your Azure subscription somehow. And for that, you have two commandlets that you need to start. One is called add Azure account. That allows you to authenticate. And if I start this, it will prompt me for a username and the password. So this account here is actually a Azure AD account. You could also use certificate-based authentication, but that's not recommended anymore. You should use Azure AD. So username, password. Oops. Here we go. And once we have that, we need to select the Azure subscription, because you remember an account can have one or multiple subscriptions. So I need to select the subscription, which is called sub1 in my case. So I run this. Now I'm sitting on my subscription. What I can do now is I could start the runbook now with this, but as we know, we have to pass two parameters. First name and last name, I first have to define those parameters, which are these. So they are passed by using an array. Create the array. Now I can say, okay, start automation runbook. I need to select as a next step the Azure automation account name, which is provided here, ZEAUT00. And then the name or the ID of the runbook, and then pass the parameters. And if I do this, this should start my runbook. Ooh. Okay, I didn't define this. Sorry. It should work now. Hopefully. Now, when going back to Azure, I can see that, yeah, this is the first runbook I triggered from the browser. And you can see the next one, that's the one I just triggered from the Azure module that's starting right now. And if I go to the one that we triggered before, I can see the summary, so I can see when was it started. Yeah, here we go. Started, the last update means when was it completed, the Azure automation account, subscription ID, things like that. Started by, I can see the user who started it, can see the status, it's completed. I can see the input parameters, and also the output, which is the concatenated name in that case. And you also have the history, where you can see details. So if you use kind of verbose output in your workflow, you can see it here. So for instance, in this runbook, I just had a write verbose saying this. So I'm now concatenating the names. You can see it in here. And then once this was done and it output the new object, I can see that here as well. And the cool thing here is that I can also see the source. So I can see what runbook or what runbook version created that history. Because it's possible that the runbook changed meanwhile, but in here I can still see what version of the runbook was triggered at that time and created those objects. So I can see the history of my runbooks if they changed. A cool thing. Good, quick deep dive into another runbook that you would need is this here. As you have seen with the Azure Active Directory module, I had to define what Azure account I want to use and to what subscription I want to connect. And we've discovered before or seen before that the runbook workers that are executing the runbooks, they live outside of my automation account. So that means when they start a runbook, they first need to connect back to my subscription and to my Active Directory account, to my Azure account, sorry. That's a little bit different compared to something like SMA. And that means that you need that kind of runbook every time you want to talk to your Azure subscription. And as you can see here, it does exactly the same that I did when I just triggered the runbook from my client. So I first add an account, but in here you can see that I don't have it hard-coded, but the value is received from the global assets up here. So the credentials are read with that command, and the Azure subscription name is read with that command. And once I have those values, I can then just say, okay, add Azure account, pass the value, and then select subscription, pass the value of the subscription name. And then I would be connected from the Runbook Workers to my Azure subscription, and I can now start doing anything I want, like creating new VMs or shutting down my lab or whatever. And just as a last example, I will go to this Runbook here where you can see that. It's called, yeah, Start My Azure IaaS Lab. I have some VMs running in here in Azure. It's a pretty simple example, but good to see how this works. So again, first I get some information from the global assets, like the service name where my VMs are running in, or the name of my domain controller, because I want to make sure that this guy starts first. Then this is added for some logging stuff. So normally when we work in complex automation projects, we build additional logging solutions just to make sure we have much more transparency compared to the dashboards that you just saw. And then what we do is we call this runbook that connects us to our Azure subscription. So the one we just saw, right? In here it's a pattern called pattern 02. But it's exactly the same as the one that you just saw before. So first we connect back to our Azure subscription, and once we have done that, we can then start doing things like starting our VMs and things. If I start this runbook here, it should take some time, then we can see the progress afterwards. Good. I already mentioned that best practice for runbook authoring, use reusable or create reusable runbooks, so-called pattern runbooks, as we call them, and combine them to bigger runbooks, parent runbooks, or solution runbooks. Make sure you have a proper error handling. You might know that from PowerShell scripts already, so it's the same, like a try-catch finally something. And logging is really key. I will show you screenshots afterwards where we built a PowerShell workflow infrastructure based on SMA, not Azure Automation, but SMA, which is literally the same, where we had more than 20,000 runbooks executions in 3 days. And you can imagine if you have only the simple dashboard, you're just completely lost for troubleshooting. So make sure that you have a so-called good, you have loud runbooks that create some noise, that are telling you what they are doing by using the right verbose activity. It allows us to activate verbose outputs on a runbook level. That means if I have a write verbose somewhere in my runbook, it will not output anything until I activate the switch here. So I can easily enable and disable the verbose output on my runbook. That's pretty helpful. And also tag your runbooks to make sure that you can find them very easily. And this is just an example how this could look like. This is the advanced, let's say, logging solution that we created that really logs every runbook's execution with additional information. In that case, you can, for instance, see the input data. So the input data that was passed to the runbook before it was executed. You would also have, you cannot see it here, the output data, so that you can every time see, okay, what was the input, what was the output, is that what I'm expecting, or is there something wrong, whatever. So this is very helpful, but this is custom. If you're interested in this, just talk to me at the cocktail party, and we can talk a little bit. Good, last word, about pricing. If you want to try Azure Automation, it's completely free. For testing, up to 500 running minutes per month is completely free. Running minutes means it counts the job execution runtime, which actually is the running jobs are counted. Not the starting and not the failed and not everything else. It's only the jobs that are in running state. They are counted against this number. And once you reach 500, it just stops. If you need more, which is probably the case when you switch into production, you can switch to the basic tier. This is just a one-click thing, and you're good. And then that's the actual price. I just checked it yesterday, the day before. It's 0.2 cents per minute, which is actually not that expensive. Use cases, what can you do with Azure Automation? You could manage all or almost all of your Azure workloads. Might it be VM, might it be SQL stuff that you're running on there, might it be backups, Azure Site Recovery. Everything that lives in Azure can be managed more or less. And not also Azure things, but also things running outside of your Azure subscriptions. For instance, VMs. If you have VMs and you want to manage your VMs, of course they are running on Azure, but Azure might not have access to your VMs because you have a separate domain with separate credentials. But you can still manage those VMs by using, for instance, custom script extensions for your VMs and run PowerShell scripts inside them. And upcoming stuff, someday, is the following. We now have, oops, it's going away. Maybe it's because I'm a little bit over time. Beamer's gone, sorry. So we'll finish it anyway. So we will get a graphical authoring experience soon, hopefully, so that you can create simple workflows by using drag and drop experience. So more or less the same as you might know it from Orchestrator today. And we'll also get role-based access control that allows you to protect your assets, protect your runbooks, and use really role-based access to your Azure Automation stuff. And that said, I'm over, I guess, 10 minutes over time. If you have any questions, I will be available outside at the cocktail party, and let's have talks. Otherwise, enjoy the party, and have a safe trip back home. Thank you.